I can see a number of other folks have joined us. So we'll just quickly get it underway. Many thanks for joining us for this Alliance for Science live session. We call it the AFS live session. From whatever part of the world that you are joining us from, many thanks for making the time to join us for this particular conversation. My name is Joseph Opoku-Gakwo. I'm a journalist. I'm an environment, agriculture, and rural development journalist based in Ghana. Welcome to today's edition of the AFS Live Sessions. It's on the theme, GM crops, upending the agroecology rhetoric. Now, there's a quick background to this, just to bring us all up to speed, even as we get the conversation underway. During the Christmas break, specifically on the 27th of December, 2021, the Scientific American, which is actually one of the most popular science magazines here in the USA, published an opinion piece written by Aniket Agar, who teaches environmental studies and anthropology at the Kriya University in India. And there was a co-author to that particular piece, Maya Montenegro DeWitt, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Environmental Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Now, this particular piece was titled How Biotech Crops Can Crash and Still Never Fail. That was actually the topic of this particular article. And to a certain extent, it generated quite some conversation on social media because the Scientific American enjoys very wide readership. It prides itself as a magazine that's had many famous scientists, including Albert Einstein, contribute articles to it. And it's actually been in print since 1845 in the USA. And so what it puts out actually draws quite some conversation. And this particular piece that was put out essentially sought to make the point, in summary, that, you know, GM crops are rooted in what is described as a colonialist capitalist model of agriculture, which is based on the theft of indigenous land and also on the exploitation of farmers and food workers, as well as women bodies across the world. That's, in summary, the point that was actually made. And the Alliance for Science in particular was singled out as one of those organizations most implicated in this model of exploitation. And there's been conversation around this. The Scientific American doesn't allow for kind of contributions and responses to pieces that are published in that particular magazine. And so then, well, we're having this conversation just to go through a number of the issues that came up in that particular piece to then actually have us all talk about it. The Alliance for Science Live actually did reach out to Moya Montenegro DeWitt, asking that Moya joins this conversation, but Moya declined being part of this particular conversation. So we'll run through a few of the issues that were actually raised in that piece in a bit, but I have quite a panel of folks all from the Global South who are joining us for this particular conversation. Joining us is Patricia Nanteza, who is the Alliance for Science Associate Director of Training and is also the founder of Science Stories Africa. Patricia, a very good afternoon to you, I guess, as you join us from Nairobi.
Yes, it's actually good evening, Joseph. It's 6 p.m. here, and it's always a pleasure to talk about biotech and Africa and with all my colleagues from the Alliance. To answer your first question, or you're still doing introductions?
Let me just do that quickly, and then we get on to the set of questions. Also joining us all the way from Bangladesh is my very good friend, Arif Hussain. Arif is Chief Executive Officer and also the Executive Director of Farming Future Bangladesh. Arif, thanks very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Joseph. And thanks, everyone, for joining today's discussion. We are looking forward for a very good discussion today.
I'm looking forward to learning a lot myself. And also joining us is Nasib Mugwanya, who is a doctoral candidate of Agricultural and Extension Education at the North Carolina State University. Nasib used to work as an agricultural extension agent back home in Uganda. Nasib, thanks for your time.
Thank you to Joseph. Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Love it. You all at the Alliance are doing a great job.
Let me quickly jump into the issues. I would rather not spend a lot of time trying to summarize anymore a lot of the issues that came up, because then they would come up in the course of the conversation. But to begin with the three of you, and specifically starting with Patricia, in this particular piece, the authors make the point that GM crops are rooted in a colonial capitalist model of agriculture, which is based on theft of indigenous land and on exploiting farmers and food workers, labor, women's bodies, indigenous knowledge, and the web of life itself. Patricia, can this be correct?
Joseph, that is an interesting, very interesting accusation. And I would like to give the example of the few African countries that I know that actually have a GM crop in farmer fields. South Africa led the way several years ago, over a decade ago. I am not from South Africa. Just recently we had Kenya and Nigeria join. This one, these two particular countries, I'm well versed about their journey of GM, and we haven't had any stories of land theft specifically being targeted for growing biotech. You're a farmer, you own your land, they give you biotech seed, you accept it, you grow it. But so in a nutshell, no, it is not true. I have not seen it documented anywhere on the African continent that those accusations are true, but I would like to throw that out. Which particular countries is she referring to?
Good question there. Let's expand on that a bit further. Arif Hussein is joining us from Bangladesh. Any thoughts on that bit?
Joseph, I mean, I should echo Patricia. For example, in Bangladesh, as you all might know, that BT eggplant or brinjal is the first genetically engineered crop, vegetable crop, resistant to eggplant fruit and shoot borer insect. And it was developed and approved for commercial cultivation back in 2013. And until today, we have more than 65,000 smallholder farmers who actually benefited from the crop. I'll share more detail later part of the discussion today about the crop. So what I should say that in this part of the world, in Asia particularly, where we share almost like 1/5 of the total population of the world, this biotech crop and this technology are actually used by mostly smallholder farmer. We don't see major large corporations as we see in Western territory, in the Western world. So I would say that this technology, this particular tool are greatly benefiting and are actually targeted for farmer and for the consumers who can greatly benefit from it.
Key point there. Naseeb, your thoughts as well on that opening question?
Thanks, Joseph. You know very well that I'm from Uganda. Actually, my grandma was a smallholder farmer, and I've been partly involved, you know, since as a kid, working on her field, you know, with small, of course, activities that kids can do, like weeding. And I would say GM crops in Uganda are rooted in the contextual realities of the challenges facing agriculture and smallholder farmers. And if anything, I think GM crops complement indigenous knowledge agriculture solutions. They help smallholder farmers, especially women farmers, spend less time in the fields as they grow more nutritious crops for their households and communities. And Joseph, I want to say this as well, that conversations on GM crops tend to be quite intense, especially when you're responding to articles with strong claims like the one in Point. And I hope I will spend more time not to miss the underlying concerns in that article that I think could be valid and why I think GM crops could be part of the solution and not the problem. Because oftentimes it's easy to deal with the problems in the article, which I think there are very many in that article, but I hope I can be more charitable to speak to some of the underlying concerns and why GM crops could potentially actually be part of the solution.
We'll get to some of those specifics in a jiffy, but the other bit of it that just a quick thoughts on before we delve into the more detailed bit of it. The point was made that GM crops have already saturated markets in corn, canola, and soy in the North and South America, and that agribusiness is eyeing markets in lower income countries and looking at smallholder crops such as eggplants, millet, and cassava. And essentially, the point the authors make is that that is primarily the reason why GM crops are being introduced in the global South. Particularly the bits having to do with BT eggplant sounds interesting. Arif, do you agree with this suggestion that GM crops are getting to places like Bangladesh, mainly because agribusiness from the global North needs to one way or the other provide market for their produce in the global South?
I should reply, it's a great question, Joseph, thank you. I mean, the agri business is a complicated issue. You literally can't put it and can't polarize it while we are having a situation with like open market and things like that. For example, you know, like Bangladesh is the country where we are almost self-sustained in our own product. The country had a history of famine back in 1974. But from that, we are now self-sustained for grain crop. For vegetable crops, we have significantly improved. And for fish and meat and other dairy production, we also improved drastically in the last couple of decades. But now the question comes that for sustainability and for the improved livelihood, you need to ensure nutrition, you need to provide safer food, and you need to improve the life of farmer. And then the question comes that does it or are these new technologies helping? And are these new technologies backed by Western influence or not? I'd say that no. Countries are now much more stronger to make their own decision. Farmers are now much educated. I mean, you know, this life that we are having today, you might find some farmer from northern country, northern territory of Bangladesh watching it from their smartphone. So you literally can't like lie with people now today when you have like a lot of information available and you just simply ask anyone to do anything. People take their own decision now. So the technology that we are having in Bangladesh, as I mentioned earlier, that back in 2013, we had BT eggplant, and with success of BT eggplant, the research and other investment in this sector has been significantly improved. And our government, along with international partners and private companies, they all are looking forward to a futuristic, technological, more advanced, modernized agriculture. Because we have a very small limited land, and end of the day, we need to make sure that 160 million people of Bangladesh are well fed three times a day, and this food is secured. So I should say that the claim that this article, particularly talking about this article, and some of the other people in our neighboring countries, for example, people who support Vandana Shiva and all their lives, they are constantly repeating the same information that they were trying to convey people in last decade. So these are not true. If it was true, then back in 2013, only 20 farmers received seedling of BT eggplant. but now we have a number of more than 65,000. So I think these numbers actually resonate the information and the fact.
Thanks. So Arif is obviously not convinced that one way or the other, people in Bangladesh or even in that region could be influenced mainly by the commercial interests, specifically alone, to then adopt some of these crops. Patricia, do you get that sense as well, operating in Africa with the work that you do in trying to introduce some of these technologies to farmers and smallholder producers in that part of the world? Do you get the sense that it's all happening just for the commercial interest of it and for the benefit of big ag in the global north?
Absolutely not. I would like to first of all reiterate Arif's point of farmers are smart. Farmers are not stupid. I would like to tell a story of a farmer that we visited in Barara. Was on that visit, and we asked the lady to actually take a GM banana plant if it were on the market, and she said, "I would take a few and then get a seed in my main plantation and then test it, see how does it perform, how is it affecting my other plants, and if it's doing what you've promised that it's doing, then eventually I would integrate it in my plantation." So those are the farmers that we are dealing with. I think this lie or the accusation that people in Africa or in Asia, we are just open to anything that comes from the West, should actually stop. At a certain point, I feel that it's insulting. But also it's further more insulting to farmers, for everyone, whether from the West or even us advocates of innovation in agriculture, to assume that they don't understand their problems and they will take on whatever it is that we put before them. So no, it's not true. And maybe Joseph, just now to flip the question and answer it in a more positive way, is why has biotech come onto the continent of Africa? Because of the challenges that farmers are facing. I'll give some specific examples of Matoke. We are dealing with banana bacterial wilt. So that is why scientists are using that technology in bananas to deal with that problems. We are dealing with low vitamin A levels in bananas, in a crop that is widely eaten in Uganda. That is why we are using biofortification. And I'm sure Nasib will talk more about how this technology is being used in other crops. So in a nutshell, biotech is on our continent, or it's in Asia, to deal with the challenges that our farmers are dealing with.
Let me hand it over to Nasib. Your thoughts on that question?
Thanks, Joseph. And I would say, like how Patricia has said, that biotech, to start with, it's a tool. And oftentimes, you know, conversations like this tend to not be productive because there's broad use of terms like GM crops. And I love to always be precise in language in terms of, you know, which GM crops are we talking about here, and what farming contexts are they being deployed in? And I would say right now, as I said, in Uganda, the challenges farmers are facing, ranging from the changing climate to the chronic pests and diseases to, you know, soils getting less fertile, a justification for using biotech in addition to other existing tools to improve crops and animals. And I will point out an example of a key food security crop that is widely eaten in Uganda by over 13 million Ugandans, which is cassava. And it's currently under threat from two major viruses. And this is a brown streak virus that makes the edible part of the crop not edible to animals and humans. And there's also the cassava mosaic disease, which cripples the edible part. And you realize that all other tools that have been deployed to address this challenge have not given much promising results in terms of addressing it. And so far right now, biotech offers one of the tools that is taking this viral challenge head on. And so when it comes to the application of biotech in places like Uganda, it's not just a luxury of maybe scientists experimenting with new science or corporations or, you know, government agencies trying to, you know, take advantage of the science. It's because of the real challenges that I've identified. And that's why we need to have a very nuanced conversation on, you know, GM crops and how they can benefit farmers in different contexts.
So key point there, focusing on the specific technologies and the point being that it's a tool, it's the use of it that then justifies the positive or negative bits of it. But in the context of that same conversation, the authors made the point about how, you know, the Food System Summit that just ended sometime in September last year, which was actually climaxed in New York with that 3-day conference. The authors made the point about how, among others, that particular summit offered a number of solutions to dealing with the food insecurity challenges, including biotechnology. And the authors made the point that, you know, biotechnology is unsustainable, it's unjust, it's a people unfriendly way of growing crops, and went on to make the point that the summit ended up advancing biotechnology and digitalization as vital tools of meeting the sustainable development goals, but the authors faltered that and said that these are not tools that can help deal with some of the challenges with regards to the sustainable development goals. Patricia, let me throw this to you. Is there a role that you think biotechnology broadly, GM crops specifically, could play in helping meet the sustainable development goals going forward, at least over the next 8 years or so, if we are to meet those goals of eradicating poverty, eradicating hunger and all?
Okay. Thank you, Joseph. And I would like to follow Nasib's lead or Nasib's lead, or the word escapes me, but where he says that in order to make sense of this conversation, we need to look at biotech specifically in particular crops, because biotech is just a tool. So if we look at it in broad terms, then we are going to have very difficult conversations that don't lead us to a solution. So the UN development goals are 17, but there are specifically maybe three that biotech can actually provide a solution to, and that is zero hunger, quality education, and good health. And the good thing about these particular three development goals is that they are actually the foundation of all the other goals, apart inclusive of access to clean water. If these four are not met, we cannot then go on and meet the others, because this is the basis of a quality of life. So reduced hunger is actually self-explanatory. If biotech is deployed in particular crops to either deal with the, to either provide disease or insect resistance, like we see in cowpea that has just been deployed in Nigeria, that is Maruca pod borer resistant, then we actually see farmers getting a higher yield. And the higher yield means more food on people's plates. And it's not just more food, it's affordable food. Then the price will drastically go down. So that is one example of how a biotech can actually deal with zero hunger. When it comes to quality education, I get very excited about biofortification. Because in biofortification, you're bringing nutrients closer to the people who need them, but in a very sustainable way. For instance, I'll talk about the vitamin A banana, where the banana has been genetically engineered to produce its own increased levels of vitamin A. The research shows that 38% of Ugandan children are vitamin A deficient, 68 in Mozambique. And I tried to find out the figures for the US. Do you know what came up on my screen? Vitamin A deficiency is very rare in the US, okay? So maybe because they have fortified most of their foods. And another thing before I continue, Joseph, that I would like to make very clear is the beneficiary in mind when these crops are actually being developed. Most of these crops, the beneficiary in mind is the rural African. I'm sure it is the rural Asian. This person who doesn't have access to fortified cornflakes, you know, to fortified cooking oil. So they need to grow their own vitamin A. And what vitamin A does in terms of quality education and good well-being is that then it makes your body fight off disease. So children are healthier. Women of reproductive age are healthier, but then also they have an increased cognitive capacity when they go to school. They actually sit and understand getting quality education, which is also not free, not 0% free in most African countries. So if your father or mother is getting higher yield, which means slightly more income for them, and then you're also you're not in a hungry state in school, then we are contributing to quality education and good health. So I would like to leave the others to my colleagues to expound. Thank you, Joseph.
Sure. So quality education, good health, you make the point about how biotechnology plays a role in meeting some of these expectations in the context of the sustainable development goals. And I would want to delve a bit more into the bit of good health, because then golden rice gets mentioned in the conversation as far as the criticism is concerned. And, you know, the authors made the point that there's been marked success in combating vitamin A deficiency without the golden rice. And we know that the golden rice is a vitamin A GMO rice that recently got approved in the Philippines. The authors made the point that nutrition education, capsule supplements, and other programs in the Philippines have actually brought vitamin A deficiency down from a peak of somewhere around 40.1% in 2003 to 15.5% in 2018-2019. My next question will be to Arif. Within that context, do countries in Southeast Asia region actually still need golden rice to combat challenges like night blindness that actually occur from vitamin A deficiency, and why? Especially when the point has been made that other tools have been used to drastically reduce some of these challenges, which haven't been biotech focused. Arif?
It's an interesting question, Joseph. I should rather ask that why golden rice should not be there and crops having similar trait with additional nutrition. You mentioned about that the vitamin A deficiency has reduced drastically from 2003 to in recent years from 40 to around like 15. But that is not specifically equal for all the family that you have here. For example, in Bangladesh, I can say that during COVID pandemic, nearly 13% families are actually deprived from proper nutrition or nutritious food. For golden rice, there are options in every country now. You have fruits, you have vegetable, you have carrot, you have tomato, you have cucumber, you have any like vegetable and fruit with beta carotene. But my point is that golden rice can actually play a very important and complementary role. People who are actually deprived and are not getting the equal access to nutrition. For example, out of every three children that we have in Bangladesh, preschool or preschool going children, they are actually suffering different kind of malnutrition, including vitamin A deficiency. even in 2022. The study came from UNICEF. And nearly like 20 to 30% of our pregnant women and mother, they also require nutrition. So does golden rice have any issue? People couldn't find any. Is it really worthy to invest in golden rice? Definitely it is, because for a rice-eating nation like Bangladesh, this is the simplest way by which you can maximize the impact of a more healthier, you know, like future citizen you can expect. So I think golden rice and other crop that we are having, for example, it could be integrated in cassava or in banana or in tomato or even in fish or any other, because, you know, like our resources are actually declining day by day. So we have to consider maximizing the utilization of our resource. We have to add value to it. For example, along with golden rice, Bangladesh is actually developing rice enriched with iron and zinc. So when people talk about only golden rice and keep a like, a very cautious notion that you people are only dealing with golden rice and beta carotene. No, our scientists and researchers are also looking into developing rice that will have zinc and iron, because these are also two additional micronutrient element required, very much required for our children and for our mother. So I think the blame that has been, you know, like the finger that has been set to golden rice for last 30 years, I should say. Now it's a time to take the decision whether you will allow 190 million preschool child every year to die, or whether you approve golden rice.
So Arif, what I'm hearing from you is that yes, all those other processes, including nutrition education, capsule supplements, and all, may have made a difference in trying to deal with the challenge of vitamin A deficiency, but golden rice is a tool that can be used additionally to make a bit more difference beyond what these other processes have made in the past, and should possibly be given the window to then also make its own difference. I see a number of questions in the chat relating to, among others, gene editing and the role it can play in helping deal with some of these challenges. We would get to that in a while with yourself and other members of the panel, but quickly to jump onto this, particularly in the Asian region, India gets mentioned a lot in the conversation around GMOs. The authors, for example, in that piece made the point that when you look at the introduction of BT eggplants, it's stalled in India for several years because of concerns, including antibiotic resistance in consumers and threats to biodiversity. So that point is made that it could possibly pose that threat and that's how come it's stalled in the Indian region. The organization has done a lot of work trying to champion the adoption of BT eggplants in Bangladesh. Are these concerns really real in the Southeast Asia region, and from what you know of what's happening in India? And are you concerned about these issues with possible antibiotic resistance in Bangladesh, for example?
Absolutely not. The antibiotic resistance actually came from misuse of antibiotics, not from the BT technology. There are like reports of antibiotic resistance from WHO all expert, but that because of misuse of antibiotic. If you go in any like medicine store in Bangladesh, some 3 or 5 years back, it was very easy for people to procure any antibiotic. But now government has played a very strict role. I mean, you can't simply get antibiotic over the counter. So the resistance, the claim and the blame to GMO, particularly BT technology, is not true. There are a few additional questions that comes along with, you know, like this relationship that we have in Bangladesh and India about BT eggplant and then BT cotton, particularly. I should mention that too. So BT cotton, India was actually a cotton importing country. Back in 2000, in early 2000, they were mostly importing cotton. But now you see, like India is one of the largest cotton exporting country. And when that comes in forward, then people trying to say that, okay, due to BT cotton, farmers are committing suicide. Due to BT cotton, you know, like farmers are losing their rights and everything. But these are all rubbish and not true. Because we have seen all these like studies and all these things done.
Yeah.
I have one paper, the study that we did on, I'm not sure whether you can read it or not, but I can share it maybe. So the impact of BT eggplant that we have here, so the BT eggplant can actually reduce 57% of the pesticide use, and nearly it gets like $450 for a smallholder farmer, additional payment, and the 39% reduction in the pesticide quality, and 47% reduction in the cost of applying pesticide. So these figures and numbers all are benefiting the farmer. But despite having all this study, all these, you know, like fact, India and the activists, they were so much powerful that they did not allow BT eggplant to be grown by farmer. But in last couple of years, we have seen that farmers out of their own, you know, like protest, they started growing BT eggplant illegally. Even then they were trying to blame Bangladesh. That okay, you people are smuggling BT eggplant seed from Bangladesh. But no, farmers somehow, the event, the variety they started growing in India, actually it's not the same thing from Bangladesh. So my point is that you can't deprive people from technology. Even for the case of cotton, India's government was under pressure, were under pressure to approve BT cotton because farmers were illegally growing BT cotton across the country. And then they thought that, okay, we should go in. And when they are getting money from it, then they don't have problem with it. Indian people are comfortable consuming seed, cotton seed well, but they are not comfortable and not willing to approve GM mustard, which has been approved by the technical committee in India. Whereas India is one of the largest, you know, like mustard oil importing country. So these are like, you know, when you mix politics with science, when you let politicians decide about what is required or not, then it becomes very complicated. When you have European influence, when you have Western influence to make call, when you have articles like it, you know, like reaching hundreds and thousands of readers with all lies, then things get tough for this Asian territory.
Thanks, Arif. I'm eager to move on to Nasib, because then there's a lot of conversation around agroecology, and I know Nasib has spent a lot of time digging into that particular subject. But Arif, very quickly, on the India bit, the point is made in the piece about how following the large-scale adoption of BT cotton, within a few years, we've seen a situation where there's escalating use of pesticides among farmers who grow BT cotton specifically in India. In 30 seconds, just quickly on that, from what you know, is that what is happening?
See, I mean, every crop has their own prescription. And for, as Patricia earlier mentioned, that biotech crop is like case-by-case incident. It's a case-by-case, you know, like control or management, whatever you think. The treatment you have for BT eggplant is not applicable for golden rice, is not applicable for cassava. So for BT eggplant, you know, some of these like earlier trait and variety which they approved, they raised some, you know, like resistance naturally, because farmers were not applying proper refugia. They are not planting non-BT cotton seed. Sorry for BT eggplant, it would be BT cotton. They are not planting non-BT cotton seed. So the prescription from scientist or from the extension official is that when you are planting BT seed, then you have to put refugia of non-BT, because you need to keep the pest alive. Otherwise, they will get some, you know, like natural. So it's a part of IPM, Integrated Pest Management System.
Yeah.
You need to comply with that. So there's nothing to deal with any, even for like conventional crop, every 3 or 4 year, we get new pesticide, new formulation. Why? Because all these pests, they grow natural resistance, you know?
Very well. It obviously goes back to the point that when you paint the entire conversation with a single brush, you see it differently depending on the direction that you're coming from. And you know, different crops have different attributes and deal with specific challenges that more attention needs to be paid to. But Nassif, to move on to the other bit, the concluding part of the article made a point about how, in terms of dealing with the challenges with food insecurity that we have globally and all of that, rather than celebrate grossly inadequate and unscientific solutions, the global community must support agroecology within a governing framework of human rights, peasant rights, and food sovereignty. This shouldn't stop anyone from supporting other technologies like biotechnology. And to a certain extent, biotechnology can fit within those contexts of human rights, peasant rights, and food sovereignty, couldn't it?
Thanks, Joseph. And as I said earlier, you know, like I'm not a big fan of broad terms because sometimes they mean, you know, like they're very confusing. And when you see a lot that is packed in that statement, it there is so much, even if you put GM crops out of the picture, that you can also use against other existing technologies that are trying to help farmers. But I would like to explicitly say that the current narrative around alternative thinkings to transforming food systems, where like the author tries to actually sell the notion of agroecology, they tend to make it seem like, you know, if you don't go biotech, go agroecology. And I'm like, you're already committing a fundamental error there. Like, one is a tool, agroecology is a farming systems approach. So we need to be careful with the dominant narrative of agroecology in how it's being constructed and sustained. And it's made to seem like, you know, it's the replacement to maybe emerging technologies or modern advances like biotech. And I would argue that in whatever forms agroecology is being promoted, whether you want to think of the science version, which I think is all embracing, it's not exclusive of, you know, modern advances in science, whichever other versions that tend to think about the food system as a whole, where you include social and, you know, political aspects of the various farming contexts, it doesn't in any way mean that a tool of biotech cannot be used to improve crops or animals. And then we sit down and see, okay, what farming system are we talking about here, which we want to look at holistically, and then which challenges are happening in this farming system and what, you know, biotech tool can best address that challenge without disrupting you know, agroecological thinking in that food system. So I think it's very important to understand that those who are pushing agroecology as though it's a replacement or a better way of thinking about the food system are sending a wrong narrative, where like biotech is a tool, and as we've said, it can be applied in so many different ways. As I pointed out, the biotech cassava, for example, that is being developed in Uganda, it's developed by a public sector agency for a common good, where what that means is that, you know, the very same deployment mechanisms that have been happening with other crop technologies that have been developed conventionally by government will still apply to the same crop, and it will still be grown with other crops that have been grown in whatever the agronomical practices that are required for that crop in the farming systems like Uganda. So it's very important for those who are pushing agroecology to not make it seem that newer advances in science cannot fit within that farming systems approach.
Still in that context, and you rightly made the point that you're not a fan of broad framing in terms of terminologies like biotechnology and all, but still within that context, the point is made in the piece about how, you know, biotechnology is path dependent and it's becoming more powerful through patents. You are referencing how in some of the situations in Uganda and elsewhere, public sector scientists are the ones developing some of these GM crops and all. But the authors make the point about how agroecology has received much less investment in research and development compared to biotech, and then goes on to say that it's become progressively harder to conduct and publish research that's critical of GM crops, and goes on to say, in effect, biotechnology has locked out other innovations, including agroecology. You are very much within the academia space, Nasib. Do you get that same sense?
Thanks, Joseph. And before I even respond to that answer, you know, my wish sometimes is that I really wish Western academics that are working on matters of food systems transformation spent a year or two in the developing world to sort of, you know, get a perspective and nuance that you often don't get in books or conferences about these complex problems. Because, you know, academics tend to over-problematize issues from sometimes a very distant reality of what is happening on ground. And I would say, for example, on the aspect of funding, in the organization that I was working in, which is the National Agricultural Research Organization, biotech only takes like less than 10% of the funding portfolio for crop development. It's less than 10%. And the 90% funding goes to actually conventional thinking around improving crops and animals. And biotech is only funded where it gives a promising headway to address some of the problems that other technologies or research is not addressing. So it's not true that actually biotech is getting most of the funding. Like in contexts like where I was working for, where I was working. And that's why it's very good to always have these nuances to these conversations. And the other point about funding being dedicated to biotech, I would go back to what Patricia said, that, you know, there was what was there before biotech came into the picture. Think about it. It's just about maybe 30 years now since 1996 when we first saw the first commercially, you know, deployed GM crops. And there was 50 years of whatever was there. I don't want even to dig, but there was funding that was definitely going into that. And we saw how much maybe that contributed to the food systems transformations we needed to see. And biotech is only less than 30 years of, for me, like in my understanding, where it's getting really this investment. So if we are to think about funding, and this is my opinion, it should be based on really what evidence shows would work in some of these farming contexts where these challenges are happening. Or what, you know, promises to work. And so whether, you know, it's biotech that, to me, I wouldn't be concerned about whether biotech is the one being funded, if it's really the one having a promising solution. And I wouldn't worry about, you know, indigenous knowledge, you know, evidence, if it's really showing promising headway to deal with some of these complex challenges. So I think funding should be based on what works in the different farming contexts. That's my opinion.
Sure. Speaking of making a headway, I'll be getting to a number of the questions in the chat that discuss CRISPR and gene editing. And Patricia will probably provide some perspectives on that for us. But just before we make that headway, a point is made in the article again that I would quickly want to take Arif's comments on before then. You know, we spend the last 10 minutes or so looking ahead. Stepping back from the GMOs conversation, the authors make a point that the whole concept of the green revolution has caused soaring farmer debts, depleted soils, and threatened native seeds and biodiversity, and as well caused the emergence of novel pathogens and increased our vulnerability to pandemics. And the authors reference the Southeast Asia region. as far as those challenges have been concerned. Arif, what kind of verdict do you see on the ground when it comes to the impact that things like improved seeds, fertilizers, and other green evolution tools have made in dealing with the challenges with food, even before we get into the biotech conversation and the GMOs conversation? Just briefly on that in like a minute or two, and then we look at the way forward.
Joseph, as I mentioned earlier, that Bangladesh was one of the countries and the government particularly who embraced the green revolution and looked forward to high-yielding crop varieties. And during that time, I learned from my father, he watched the green revolution in his life. My father is a farmer. And the way he mentioned that in small plot, how significant improvement we have now with high yielding variety. Well, you definitely need to feed well your plant to get more crop. But that is making sure that you get enough grain to feed your family, to save and to sell in the market. So during that time, when we had the green revolution back in 80s and 90s, then there were a lot of protests against it. People were, you know, like activists and all those people, they were coming forward in the field. They were misguiding farmers that, okay, don't feed your child with this high yielding rice variety. Your child will be blind. Your child will not be in good shape. But now they stopped blaming it. They don't even raise any question. A few years back, they were raising question about hybrid. But now if you go in a vegetable shop in Bangladesh, you will find winter crops around the year. You will see tomato around the year. You will see cucumber around the year. Is it required? Definitely it is required. How could you feed the people? So the message and the blame, the same blame are going actually for the biotech crop. Mm. I mean, I like to generalize biotech crop. Definitely it's a, like specific case by case, says Nasib mentioned, but it feels happy for me when, you know, like I hear any blame or claim from the activist group. Similarly, I want to tell them that, okay, biotech crop are actually providing a much more advanced solution. Maybe yeah. Patricia and Nasib can talk more about gene editing. But the lie that, we are running out of time, but I'll finish it faster in that. With the technology, people are now smart enough to reduce fertilizer use. They have better prescription. They're reducing, you know, like the water use, the irrigation. So modernization are actually helping to address some of the challenges that we are having some 30 years back.
Very
so things are changing. And I think biotech and all these tools are actually one step forward to what we had in Green Revolution. And we are looking forward to Gene Revolution.
I like the way Arif rather wants to look it up broadly when you talk of biotechnology. Nasib makes the point about focus on the specific technology. So obviously the varying perspectives are interestingly needed if you don't make a headway with the conversation. But Lion Kasun has a question in the chat that maybe Patricia could begin with in terms of responding to. With the advent of CRISPR and other gene manipulating technologies, development of GM crops is more attainable than ever, potentially allowing regional universities and local companies and labs to develop their own GM crops. And then Line makes the point that this would help to convey the concern that GM seed stocks are being largely controlled by large foreign corporations. And then goes on to ask, to what degree is regional development of GM crops occurring in the countries represented in the panel today? And, you know, limiting that to gene editing, to what extent is gene editing playing a role in helping overcome the challenges with food situations and all? From what you know in the region where you operate, Patricia, any thoughts on that?
Okay, speaking for sub-Saharan Africa minus South Africa, I know only Kenya, led by the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture, IITA, under the leadership of Dr. Lina Tripathi, who is actually on our advisory board. That is the only lab that I know in Africa where actual gene editing is taking place. And Lina and her team are working on two particular crops. One is banana and they're using gene editing. Eventually, that gene editing is going to confer resistance to BXW, bacterial wilt resistance, and yam. That yam is being worked on in Nairobi, but destination Nigeria. So those are the only crops that I know are actually under research. But I would like to talk about briefly the advantage of gene editing, genome editing, and how it's going to help us. For me, my greatest concern is not that GMOs are a colonial tool and globalization and things like that. For me, my major concern as an African, as a consumer, someone who works with farmers, is the perception issue that foreign bodies are being put in our food, and genome editing is going to help with that, because it's going to help us get to the solution.
Yeah. Patricia's line is a little rough there, but Patricia makes the point that, you know, gene editing could help deal with some of the perception challenges that GMOs have faced over the years going forward, which is what I'm hearing from her, even as her line kind of breaks a bit there. But Patricia, thanks very much. I'll actually take that as your final word, even as we round up this conversation in the next 2 minutes or so. Naseeb, concluding thoughts?
But my concluding thoughts, Joseph, would be that whichever way
genetic engineering would have gotten us to silencing.
Okay, Naseeb, go ahead, please.
Yeah, my concluding thoughts about whichever way we want to think about food systems change or transformation, and whatever position one takes on biotech, we need to be very cognizant of the reality of the farming challenges that we are addressing today. And to me, it's very important for everyone who is thinking about addressing these challenges to approach them with that humility and complex thinking, and not to, you know, make it seem like one tool is better than the other. We need all the tools in the toolbox. And most importantly, any farming systems approach, whether it's agroecology or whatever will come after that, should never limit farmers to what they should have access to. Let farmers be at the center of the food system, and let them be given the choice to choose what works for them in their different farming contexts. Thank you.
Naseeb, thank you. Arif, in a minute or less, concluding thoughts.
I think after what Naseeb has summarized, I hardly have anything to add. The one thing I need to add along with Naseeb is that the technology need to move forward, and let not it remain confined only for the like decision makers' decision. It should move forward the way scientists conduct research, the way farmers require them on the field.
Many thanks for joining us. It's been a good conversation, I think. Arif Hossein is Chief Executive Officer of Farming Future Bangladesh. Many thanks for joining us for this conversation. Naseeb Mugwanya is a doctoral candidate at the Department of Agriculture and Human Sciences at the North Carolina State University, originally from Uganda, where he worked as an agricultural extension officer. Patricia Nanteza is Director of Training at the Alliance for Science. Patricia, thanks very much for those thoughts. Your line was breaking, you kind of breaking along the line as we got to the latter end of the conversation, but I think a lot of the thoughts you expressed getting to the end were very much heard about how gene editing could help overcome some of the challenges that are associated with GMOs when it comes to the perception bit of it. So many thanks very much for those thoughts. And my name is Joseph Opoku-Gakwu. I'm an environment, agriculture, and development journalist based in Accra, Ghana. Many thanks to you all. Another edition of AFS Live will be up soon. Many thanks to the team as well for all the support, including John Conroe and Modesta Bugu. For now, we are out. Thanks. Chris, thanks very much for the technical support and all the other support as well. Have a nice evening. Have a nice morning and have a nice afternoon. Bye.